Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a gentleman who started out as a scientist, a researcher, moved into sort of policy on trying to increase the workforce, if you like, for scientists, and is now a senior fellow in science education at the Howard Hughes Medical Center in Chevy Chase, Maryland. So the person is Cliff Poudre, and Cliff, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith.
So before we get on to what sort of science you did and how you made a career move and made another one, tell us a little bit of how you really got into science in the first place. When you were a young boy, what were those moments that you can look back on and say, boy, that was really a big intervention. This was a special moment.
So, you know, it's kind of hard to find special moments. And growing up on the Indian Reservation, not a lot of toys, not a lot of other good things. I would say that my fascination with just life around me, my curiosity was fairly high. And I don't remember any particular encouragement, but I certainly didn't have any discouragement for just trying to understand and ask questions just about the local world around. I do have one recollection, though, of a teacher that made a difference in terms of my how I felt as a student. In seventh grade, I was in a science class in seventh grade. Teacher asked a question, as they often did then back then. You raised your hand, and he called on me, and I got it wrong. But instead of just, you know, saying wrong, the teacher said, he thought for a second, and he said, no, that's not the correct answer, but that's really good thinking. That made all the difference in the world.
Right.
And in fact, my relationship with that teacher, I think, just improved. And I tried, in part just from that little encouragement, I tried to become a better thinker. I tried to not necessarily know all of the right answers, but based on his encouragement, tried to become better at thinking about things, at understanding things, which played into a kind of natural curiosity that I had.
You know, that's so true, because one of the things we see in modern education is so many of these standardized tests, you just fill in the box. And so, in fact, there, you don't get any credit for thought, right? Whereas if you were to have a narrative where you're trying to explain the answer that you came up with, you would learn a lot more about a student. And so it's an interesting phenomenon. Now, you mentioned that you grew up on a reservation. Tell the audience a little bit about where that was, and was there any special aspect of that you look back on as a strength as you went through later life?
So the reservation is a Seneca reservation in the western part of New York State, part of the Iroquois Confederacy of tribes, and it's a relatively small reservation compared to the reservations in the Southwest. Probably about 1,200 people living on the reservation. Like many communities across the country, economically depressed, economically poor, but everyone was in that boat. So we actually didn't consider ourselves poor. I don't think we knew how poor we were because everyone was. It did mean that you had to entertain yourself with materials that were at hand, and that I think can be a good way for stimulating curiosity. It can also be a way for simulating misbehavior because you're sort of taking advantage of various things available. And I'll tell you that as a young teenager, I was interested in loud things that went bang, and so, you know, I enjoyed making my own crude rockets and other kinds of explosive kinds of things. And that actually helped me because I had to learn a little bit of chemistry. I actually had to learn a fair amount of chemistry.
I would hope so. In fact, and, I'm rather disappointed that you didn't develop into a fine chemist.
Well, I started off in that direction. Another just bit of good luck. I had a nerdy friend. And sometimes, you know, it's the people you hang around with that can make a difference. So I hung around with athletes. I played high school sports, but I also had this one nerdy friend, and the other just bit of good fortune, the chemistry teacher in the school had been a coach in his early years and had coached my uncle. So So there was already a little bit of a family connection that this guy was a good guy. He was the ref for many of the games, so I had gotten to know him from a different context and had determined that he was a good guy. Well, it turned out he really was a good guy, and he just encouraged me in a very gentle way by offering things to read. Some of them were fairly small. Some of them were books. Consequently, I actually did high school chemistry without taking the class by sort of reading it on my own with this nerdy friend because we were interested initially in things like explosives, but then it got to be a little bit more an understanding, well, you know, why does this work? How does this work? Why doesn't it just explode before you're ready?
Cliff, it does. That's what you didn't remember.
Lucky for us, it didn't. So for me, just good fortune, having that curiosity, having a teacher that I trusted that, you know, was a good guy, having a nerdy friend,
right,
got into it. Now, that did not make me a good student. I was not a particularly good student. I was not a particularly good undergraduate student.
Where did you go to? Well, first of all, was the school on the reservation?
No, the school was adjacent to or near the reservation, so it was a mixed school. It was about one-third American Indian, two-thirds local white agriculture area. It was a good school to go to. Then I went to college at the University of Buffalo, not that far away, still in western New York. And I wasn't a particularly good student. My aspiration was to become a high school football coach, but coaching jobs you couldn't do just on your own, so you had to have something else. So I thought, well, I could become a high school science teacher. But I wasn't doing spectacularly well as an undergraduate.
But you weren't in the Department of Education. I guess maybe
no.
There wasn't such a thing then.
There was, and I almost went to get a master's in education. And someone, and I don't know who that someone was, said, oh, no, you should really get a master's in science and then get a certificate in education. So that made all the difference.
Absolutely.
In the world.
That was sage advice at the time. And it would be now, too.
I went from taking classes as an undergrad to doing some research projects as a master's student. I had much closer connection with the faculty as a master's student. And my life just turned around. Also, there's a bit of socialization. While I was a master's student, one of the labs nearby had to purify their own enzyme in order to make their experiments work back in those days. And it was a 30-hour procedure, which meant that some of the members of the lab had to stay overnight and do the various procedures. And it was kind of a social thing. They invited me to, well, why don't you come see how we do this? They always wanted extra hands in the middle of the night. But I found that the social connection, actually doing something in science, was also rewarding. And each one of these little steps, from not being a good student to taking a deeper interest to being kind of engaged in the activity, each one of these little steps just ultimately ended up, you know, maybe I should really go try to get a PhD.
Right.
And instead of teaching in high school, maybe I could teach at a community college. I didn't have big visions, but a lot of the little visions led to kind of the next step in opportunity.
So tell us, let's jump then. You went away, you got a PhD. That was from where?
My PhD was from Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio.
Right. And then in the end, you landed up a faculty in California.
I ended up at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I had done a postdoc in Vancouver, British Columbia, so I had kind of been on the West Coast, and I had interviewed a couple of different places. But that institution, which had a strength in teaching, but was also a research institution, it seemed to fit what I thought would be just an ideal.
Okay, so then now you've landed up, you've got a faculty position. What did you decide to study? Because obviously when you become a faculty member at a fine university in North America, it's not just the teaching, but you have to have this research posture. What did you aim at that early stage?
So I was a developmental biologist. I tried to understand how organisms grow and develop from a single cell. And the organism that I studied was the fruit fly, Drosophila.
Everybody studies Drosophila.
Well, that's because we made progress. We made it exciting for the next generations. And it was very exciting. We were able to use the genetics of Drosophila. And my skill, what I brought to the experiments, in addition to kind of the curiosity and the study, a skill that I had developed was doing cell biology and looking at cells in the electron microscope. And I worked hard to do it very, very well. I did consciously make an effort to do this better than other people, because I had a feeling that if I could see things more clearly, I might actually get different answers. I might see things that other people missed.
So what you're talking about there, Cliff, if I can interject, is just you were trying to get images with much finer resolution?
That's correct. So instead of having slightly blurry pictures and being excited about it, I really wanted real crisp pictures so that I could learn something new.
And how did you develop that skill? What was it that you did that went from other people's blurry images to your rather real focused and fine resolved pictures?
So part of it was working a little bit harder and getting involved in all aspects of it. I learned how to take the electron microscope apart, to clean it and to realign it, because what I had learned from other people that were really good was that if the machine is slightly out of line, it'll be blurry, or if someone put in dirty samples and there was gum in the middle there somewhere, you couldn't get good pictures. So what I was told and what I picked up on was that if you take the time and you do a job really well, in some cases getting in and learning the tools, the results will be better, and people will believe you.
It's like having an old car with twin carburetors. If you get in there and do it yourself every week, it runs well. If not, it's a pain.
That's a good description.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're talking to Dr. Cliff Foudry, a senior fellow in science education at the Howard Hughes Institute in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. So when is a drug side effect a good thing?
When it restores your missing hair?
Okay, funny guy. I wish I was so lucky. Do you know the drug Cyclopirox?
Yes, it's a topical normally prescribed for nail fungus.
Well, researchers discovered a side effect of the drug is that it kills HIV-infected cells, at least in petri dishes.
Wow, that could open a whole new door for HIV research, because right now HIV therapies control viral replication, but they don't kill the infected cells. That's why people have to stay on these drugs for life, and it's expensive. In the U.S., that's $10,000 to $12,000 a year, so scientists are motivated to find a cure.
The researchers found Cyclopirox not only inhibits HIV gene expression, it also reactivates an infected cell's ability to commit suicide. Our cells innately defend against the spread of viral infection by destroying themselves, but HIV blocks this pathway.
The antifungal drug restores an infected cell's suicide pathway by stopping the function of its mitochondria, a cell's energy source. Remarkably, when the drug was removed from the cultures, there was no resurgence of HIV, indicating the cultures no longer harbored the virus.
Researchers plan to study whether applying Cyclopirox topically during sex may reduce HIV transmission. More importantly, can a pill form of the drug kill infected cells throughout the body?
The same researchers are testing a second drug called deferiprone, which reduces iron in people who have too much of it. This drug also leads to the suicide of HIV-infected cells.
As researchers look into other classes of drugs that trigger a cell suicide pathway, this approach may offer a whole new opportunity to one day defeat HIV.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Cliff Foudry from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Maryland. And we're talking about Cliff's early development as a scientist and learning something about you've got to be very precise in the instruments you use, and you've got to know well, you don't have to, but it's far better that you know precisely how they work and how you can therefore trust the data that you're getting out. And that's, I still think, true. We have education now where people use all sorts of black boxes without really understanding what's coming in and barely what's coming out.
Well, so, you know, I think in the, you talk about education, the way we teach, the way that we try to both pass information on to the next generation, but also to teach them the skills and abilities how to do this on their own, is also a bit of a black box. And many people, I think, teach much in that way. They assume that we do things, we say things, we urge students to do things, and somehow at the end of a term or the end of a couple of years, they're going to come out well-educated. It really is quite a mysterious process. Some people are very successful and learn an awful lot. Some people try hard and make less progress. The motivation of students, whether or not they really want to do it themselves, of course, plays a tremendous role. But this is somewhat of the black box of education. And that's actually what excites me now about this new opportunity that I have as a senior fellow in science education.
Before we get to that, though, I think our listeners would really be interested to know about what happened between your research career as a professor and now your position as a senior fellow. You were at the National Institutes of Health. You were in a division that had responsibility for ensuring that this nation has a ready supply of scientists, especially in the biomedical area, into the future. And this then led into the need for really encouraging people that traditionally had not been involved in science, that is mainly in this particular case, underrepresented minorities, to get into biomedical science. Why don't you talk a little bit about that transition, how you went from professor to administrator of such programs, and then come back full circle to your current position?
So while I was at the University of California at Santa Cruz, we in the faculty there had several programs that encouraged students to participate along with us in our research. We had a small number of faculty who were themselves minority faculty, Hispanic Americans, Mexican Americans, who were good at what they did. They were good at their science, and they wanted to include young people from all backgrounds into their research. This was somewhat of a change from the dominant behavior of the research universities. But we enjoyed doing that. We enjoyed the community, the diverse community of students, and enjoyed seeing these students develop in our labs and then go off into graduate education and other careers of their own. This became something of a calling, and we also recognized that it was part of a major problem in this country. How are we going to sustain the excellence in science that drives the economy of the nation? How are we going to have the ideas and the people? And we recognize that our greatest strength is our different ways of thinking, the diversity of thinking that helps to generate new ideas, the kind of things that have made the country competitive. Where are these new ideas going to come from? Who are the people? We felt, we believe firmly, that we really needed to be more inclusive than the universities had been in the past. So we did our best to reach out to provide opportunities to a broader swath of students, including women, including people with disabilities, including the various minority groups. This was both personally rewarding to see the successes of the students and to see that we could make a difference. As time went on, I did get involved in the usual kind of administrative duties at a campus, and then had an opportunity to go to the NIH where I could lead some programs and to rethink the kind of funding from the government level that might support these activities at universities around the country. And over time, this didn't just come to me all at once, but over time, I began to really realize the importance of having the benefit of diverse thinking, diverse backgrounds to our scientific society, that I had to convince others. And so that became a passion, a calling, and was something, as you mentioned, that I did then for many years at the NIH.
Let me sort of ask a question that I'm sure some people think about, and that is they say, well, we understand the need for manpower. I mean, at least I hope everybody understands that. And the changing demographic of North America, the more what used to be called underrepresented minorities are becoming less and less underrepresented, except in the sciences perhaps. But as part of the population, that's a booming population. And so we've got to do programs, we've got to inaugurate programs and strongly push them to get more of those people to think of science as an outcome. Sometimes you hear, and you said earlier, that the diversity of thought will be good for the development of society. Can you explain to some people why that would be true in the science? Just because you've got an African-American, an Englishman, lives now in America as a citizen, a Hispanic scientist, Chinese scientist, why does that diversity of thought, you think, have an impact on the progress of science itself?
So where it has an impact is for the difficult problems, for the complex problems. Easy problems, simple problems can be solved by individuals thinking really hard, just smart people working really hard. So so an old way of viewing things was that what we need for science is just really smart people who, you know, like Einstein, will theorize and come up with new ideas. But as problems, as we solve some of the simpler problems, and they get more and more complex, we need better, newer, better ways of thinking about it. And this is where different perspectives, and different perspectives that come from our experiences in different communities, different priorities, all of these play into a more complex way of thinking, so that the overall group has the advantage not just of one smart way of looking at things, but at multiple smart ways of looking at things, each from its own slightly different vantage point. So when it comes to complex problems, the hard problems that we're going to have to solve, a broader spectrum of approaches, broader spectrum of thinking will help us to solve those problems of the future.
And that's particularly true when you come to, say, social problems and medical problems, which are very broad. I mean, it's behavior, it's medicine, it's lifestyle, it's lifestyle attitudes. So these you would categorize into those very complicated problems that society faces right now.
Absolutely. We can't cure all diseases with a simple pill. Though we, you know, certainly want to do more research on kinds of things that can improve the drugs, improve the medications. But as you point out, there's a lot about behavior. There's a lot about follow through that are going to be important. And some of these are linked to socioeconomic status, which are sometimes linked to just where you live and where you grow up. And understanding this rich complexity is going to be important in having a healthy society.
Yeah, I was just talking to some counselors from different schools, and they were talking about standardized tests. You know, and we in the business are always thinking, is the GRE, the Graduate Record Exam, or the Scholastic Aptitude Test earlier on, do these in fact have any predictive value? And I think it's becoming clear that some of those tests do not have a very good predictive value. In fact, I was told that they're less useful in predicting success in college than the zip code that you live in. And that really makes you understand that these are societal problems at the most fundamental level.
Indeed. And we're learning more and more about this. I think if I were to go back to be an undergraduate student again, I might want to take some courses in behavior, in psychology. As you point out, the simple standardized tests aren't very predictive, in part because we humans are more complicated. Some of us have more motivation than others. Some of us, when we fall down, we get back up again and go for it. Others, when we fall down, we kind of feel sorry for ourselves. Some of us have more of what's called grit. And how do you teach that? How do you recognize it in students? So we're far more complex than just the result you get on a simple SAT test.
Let's now turn to your latest position, because you were at the NIH in the division to encourage more underrepresented minorities into graduate schools, but now you've left that after about 20 years, and now you are the senior fellow in the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. What does that entail? What's your hope for that position?
So I have a wonderful opportunity to be able to try to pull together ideas and colleagues to think about and to experiment with newer and better ways to improve outcomes for a diverse pool of students. There are many things that we've learned from the kinds of programs that you've had at UTEP, programs that have been all around the country, and often we believe we know what the best practices are and why they work. In this new position, I have the opportunity to work with selected universities and with a number of other scholars to try to understand more deeply and to see if we can't expand the opportunities, have them taken up by other institutions, provide the kind of both encouragement but also a bit more of the knowledge of what works and why it works.
Well, what are the problems, of course, with that, Cliff, is that best practices today may not be anything like best practices in 5 years' time. The whole revolution of communication and electronics, gadgets that we wear on our little finger almost, has completely changed the way that children get information, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know. So best practices are constantly evolving.
Absolutely, and you know, I agree with you. I actually don't like the term best practices. I think of that being better expressed for a trade, where I want the plumber to use best practices, not innovative practices. I want the electrician not to be innovative.
Yeah, exactly.
Standard practice. But in education, while we need people to certainly not use worst practices, we want people to be more innovative and more thoughtful about how to do things better.
Did you think that your activity in sport, you were alluding to at the beginning, your interest in sport, did that contribute to your own personal grit content, if I can call it that?
Absolutely. One of the things that you learn in playing sports is that not everything goes well, and sometimes you get knocked down, and sometimes you don't catch the pass, and you can either give up and whine.
Right.
Well, the coach doesn't let you do that. A good coach doesn't let you do that. But you get up and you try harder. And in sports, you often then experience the joy of success after working hard. So you see the value of practice. You see the
right
value of work.
And as we'd say in England, it makes you prepared for life being a rather sticky wicket, if I can use the cricket analogy. And once
yes,
you understand life is a sticky wicket, you got to get on with it.
That's right. And everybody falls. You just get up faster and get going again.
So Cliff Foudry, Senior Fellow in Science Education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Maryland, thank you so much for being on Science Studio. Good luck with your new venture, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about you and your results. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being with you.
Absolutely. And we'd like to thank Nolan Martinez for putting this program together so it sounds so wonderful. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for being out there. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Dr. Maya Angelou, one of the most well-known and influential voices of our time, will be the featured speaker at this year's Milagro Gala. The gala will benefit El Paso Children's Hospital, including expansion of pediatric programs and procurement of medical equipment. The gala takes place March 7th. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred, a transitional care hospital.